the four brown-haired Beitner girls. We would have given Louisa May Alcott a run for her money. Molly was not particularly maternal. Usually, when I'd ask what we were having for dinner, she'd say, "Poison," without skipping a beat. I thought it funny. Poison was the easiest conversation ender. She had a full day of work as a judge and then came home to make dinner. She was a mother at a time when work-life balance wasn't a goal that women thought about or talked about or strove to achieve. Most of the women in our comfortable Michigan suburb stayed home and raised their children. She could not have known that it was possible to both have a powerful career and be an engaged mother. Life didn't cater to children and mothers so much then. It was a different generation. She chose her work because she didn't have a choice. To do both would have been impossible. As much as I missed her because she worked long hours, I was impressed with her. It was my mother whom I revered and emulated more than anyone. I was mesmerized by her. Her smile, her makeup, her clothes, the small grape-sized birthmark on her right calf, her throaty laugh. The way she smoked, sometimes blowing out plumes through her nostrils when Lizzie yelled, "Dragon!" The way she sat behind the wheel of her car, leather-gloved hands turning up the heat in winter. The way she held her martini glass with her painted red nails during our parents' nightly cocktail hour. I was riveted by her. She was my first great love. I wanted every cell of her body to repopulate itself into mine. I wanted to become her. This feeling never faltered. Decades later, when she was suffering from neurological distress, my mother was the person whose approval meant the most to me, even when she had no idea I was there. I did not share all of these feelings with her. She was not gooey. Like Pop-Pop, my mom was a woman who believed in decorum, that there was a real dignity in keeping quiet, in being stoic and private about one's personal affairs. "Never talk about religion or politics," she reminded us. Part of this was informed by the 1950s world in which she was an adolescent. Most of it was innate to her. Growing up, I knew better than to complain about the sparks in my arms and hands that came and went, the repeating nightmares and dark thoughts that I recorded in my diary, the moments of existential anguish I felt even as a little girl. Nor did I disclose my deep desire to feel needed by her, held by her, because I was born terrified. I needed to keep very still so she wouldn't see the fear and disapprove. Still, my mother and I related through sadness in a way I think the other kids didn't. We didn't acknowledge it. It was more of an intuitive bond. I think she understood this about me, that she recognized my natural tendency toward despair because she was similarly afflicted. We were linked in this way. Once, when I was in middle school, she told me that if things ever got really bad, we could always go into the garage together. We could turn on the Corvette, seal the doors, and breathe until we didn't. "We'd be together," she said. "So you tell me." I thought she was trying to be kind. It was her wildly inappropriate way of recognizing my pain, even if it's horrifying to contemplate that a mother would suggest this to her daughter. My sisters were shocked. I see it now. She knew I was depressive, but if I told her, "Yes, let's do it," she could stop me. My mother never wore her heart on her sleeve, save for some periodic displays of anger or jest. She rarely shared anything personal, except occasionally when she was well into her cups. For as much as I watched her, for as much as I studied and revered her, sometimes I think I still don't know anything about her. All I know is that we both saw the world with a critical eye. "Realists," she'd declare about us. I also inherited her deep appreciation for a body of water, a drink, and a cigarette, and a great suit. Sustenance. Every evening at 7 p.m., our family sat down to dinner. My mother worked a full day, drove the 2 hours home, and had a full dinner, steak or chicken with greens and potatoes, spaghetti with salad, on the table. "Girls, dinner!" she called right on time. We each reported to our places in the kitchen at the Saran and Tulip table, and then we ate. Dinner on Coventry Woods Lane was almost formal. My mother still in her pencil skirt and heels, red lipstick staining the rim of the martini glass that was forever sweating at her side. My father in a cashmere sweater and tweed jacket, eyeglasses his constant prop. It was also very civilized. My mother was a Republican, and Elliot was a Democrat. This was a time when people could sit at the same table and talk respectfully about the issues of the day and their day. So they did. Our meals were rather simple. Steak, salad, spaghetti. But on the rare occasion, when we had luxury, we were always aware of it. Though in her fashion, my mother was very fatalistic about it. "Girls, these scallops are very special," she would say. "The estuaries are going away. By the time you're grown up, there won't even be scallops left." We ate off the blue and white china. Before I was able to cut my own food, my mother, who sat to my left in the master chair with the molded arms, cut my steak into bite-sized pieces, thin and pink, blood pooling around the chunk. "Now make a clock," my mother would direct, before going back to her meal, the martini glass having been replaced with a long-stemmed goblet more than half full of red wine. When we were all young, my parents shared a single bottle of wine with our meal. By the time I was 10 or so, the bottle became a Rossi jug, and the glass would be refilled until she and my father were done. After dinner, as I cleared the plates and the crumpled stained paper napkins, she stayed at the table, smoking a cigarette in the dim kitchen light. When I was about 5, with a lopsided bowl cut and a hard, round tummy, my favorite meal was spaghetti. I liked the al dente pasta with the jarred pasta sauce and especially the grated Parmesan cheese from the green Kraft canister. One night when my mother called us in for dinner, I was hungrier than usual. It was summer and Lizzie and I had played outside all day. Sweaty, salty, ravenous girls. We took our places at the table, as always, with Katie to my right, my mother on my left. My mom served me first. A plate of spaghetti with sauce and cheese. As I tried to wait for the rest of the family to be served, Lizzie's eyes were on me as I took a big bite from my plate. She announced this loudly to my mother. "Blair didn't mix her cheese in and she ate it." She said it in such an alarming way as if I'd committed a mortal sin. I felt terror, endangered. I was mortified. I was a sensitive soul, despite biting my sister's back. And my favorite Lizzie, my twin, my everything, had just looked at me with such disdain and told the wrong I'd done. Her tone turned my body cold. My mother, plating our spaghetti, didn't say anything, which meant she must agree. I didn't wait for the axe to fall. To me, this was my army, and they had turned. I didn't know how to translate shame, which in that moment felt as big as death. In my mind, I surmised I'd poisoned myself. If I didn't know I was not allowed to put unmixed Kraft in my mouth, then nothing was safe. I pushed back my chair and ran to the other end of the house. When I reached our room, I slid myself under my bed into my own little bomb shelter. I would now die under this bed. With the stained carpeting, evening already settling in. I had no compass. I didn't know. "I am sorry," I whispered inside this space. "For me, for my life, for unmixed plates of spaghetti. I am sorry. I am bad. I am sorry. I am bad." I'd later learn that old pets often go under the bed to die. After a minute, Lizzie came in. She coaxed me out. My mother called us back to the table. Unsure, I sat down and watched my sisters eat. They were careful to mix the Parmesan cheese into their sauce before they ate it. As I gazed through the lens at a life's worth of moments, a plate of Barilla spaghetti and a reprimand from my beloved sister are seemingly unimportant, but it filled in my heart from such a young age. This was one of my first introductions to shame. The same shame would keep coming as years went on. There was a whole system, I saw, that wasn't about being good or even just being. It was about authority, with rules we are not born knowing. If this was how the world worked, I was in for a rough ride. We don't know what stains a pure heart. We may not remember all those times when we follow the wrong woman in the grocery store and reach for her hand and feel the red-hot shame for this understandable error. By the time we reach adulthood, we are so accustomed to being here that we forget how big everything used to be. The trespasses that to us seem light once felt like life and death. If someone had held me and said, "Oh, honey, you're just a child. It will be okay." It might have felt okay. But I kept my secret. I became very anxious when eating in front of people. I tried to avoid meals with friends or boys. I would not eat spaghetti again until long after high school, and the shame had faded into the black of the hallway inside me, flat under the bed of my mind. Even then, the shame spilled out from under the dusty ruffles, shame upon shame. For years to come, I would believe I should not eat what was put before me. The first time I remember feeling self-conscious about my body was on picture day at Stevenson Elementary. I was in kindergarten, dressed in a royal blue pantsuit with a white cotton top. When I was brought in to have my portrait taken, the photographer looked at me and said, "What a bluebird." He meant it affectionately, a term of endearment. I still have the picture from that day, and I can now say I am objectively adorable. But at the time, what I heard was, "Bluebirds are fat. Bluebirds have fat chests and round bellies." I didn't want to look like a bluebird. I would not be fat. In due course, I grew out of being a bluebird and was, in fact, skinny. My mother would always exclaim how skinny and bony I was. I could tell by her voice that she didn't mind it. But she asked the doctor what she could do so I wouldn't look so fragile. "Beer," he said. "Put beer in her cereal. Beer is fattening." So my mother advised beer in my cereal. It tasted awful. I like cereal, and I grew to like beer, but not together. The prescription didn't take. In any event, I didn't gain a pound. In fourth grade, a teacher told me I was very thin and that it looked nice. I pointed to another girl, Mary Bernard, and said, "Look at her, though. She's skinnier than I am." And the teacher said, "No, she's small. You're thin. Enjoy it." My mother valued thinness, so I wanted to be thin. Like Pop-Up, she prized beauty above all. I had a lazy eye as a girl, which made me feel invisible, but she still believed I was the one daughter of hers who might be pretty enough to model, a profession she seemed to think my only prospect of employment. I always found this curious coming from a judge who also claimed to value education above all else. She warned me that once I got my period, I would stop growing. So she said I should try to postpone menstruation for as long as possible. As if it were a biological process I could control. "You need to be at least 5'8" to be a model," she'd say. When I saw the first drops of brown blood at the age of 11, I hid the evidence from my mother. I prayed I'd continue to grow taller, longer, leaner. I did not. When I was in seventh grade, I told my mother I had started my period. I acted surprised, as if it had only just begun. She asked how much I weighed. 90 pounds, I said. She told me not to get a pound heavier. Not a single pound. This is your weight, she said. This is your size. I have been wary of weight gain ever since. My mother was dictatorial about weight. Perhaps because she had watched her own mother grow heavy when Molly was young, she saw weight gain as a lack of control, a sign of weakness, another bias handed down from Pop-Pop, and as usually unflattering in clothing. My mother kept a diary of her weight and went through phases when she weighed herself obsessively. A few years ago, my sister and I found a detailed chart in one of her notebooks. It looked like an EKG printout. We had no idea what it was until we looked more carefully at the graph paper and realized that it was a record of her weight at every hour of the day for several years. After she retired, she'd hole up at home alone, smoking and drinking with various suitors. I'd call her to see if she'd like some company. "I can come out for a visit," I said. "Oh, don't come visit me. I'm too fat," she'd say. I knew better than to argue. Sometimes on weekends when I was little, my mother would invite me to take a nap with her, a special treat. She didn't like to be touched, so any chance to be close to her, my body aligned with hers, was sacred. I remember one time in particular, when I was 8 years old, the sky was a blank wash of gray. The few trees on the property were naked. I knew I was too old to nap, but I wanted to be near her, to smell her fraca perfume, and to be near the idea of her. She beckoned me beside her, and of course I accepted. I would do anything she wanted, anything at all. I climbed into her giant bed, resting my head on her shoulder as we lay side by side. She told me a story. I listened quietly. We were on a dog sled. "Look up at the stars, Blair," she said. "Oh, it's snowing. We're on a sled, wrapped in fur rugs, and it's so cold." I giggled, wanting her to go on. She did. "But we are safe on the sled. The dogs are running through the night. Oh, there are so many stars like sparklers held high up in the night sky. Oh, it is so beautiful and exciting." I wanted to believe her tale. I could see it then. It was a magic carpet ride, an insulation from ordinary life. I longed to turn to her and whisper, "Mother, I am scared of everything but this moment right now." But I didn't say a thing, because I didn't want her to stop. I scooted my butt closer to her. "Be still," she said. "Stop moving so much." I obeyed. She went on a bit longer, describing the sliver of moon, the frozen wind. And then she drifted off to sleep. My mother's stories were my sustenance. I repeated this one over and over in my head, feeling the furs and the stars and the snow, the rushing and whistling wind, the dogs leaping. I wondered how they knew where to go. I fell asleep, afraid as always, but safe in our sleep. But those were not the only stories she told. Sometimes she'd call me in for a nap, and I could tell by the look on her face that she was in no mood to tell me a whimsical tale. No dog sleds, no stars, no fur blanket. Instead, she'd tell me the story of how she didn't know if she wanted me. When I asked her if she loved me from the start, "Oh, I already had 3 daughters, she said. She was older, she had a career. She didn't want to have another child. Elliot didn't want this baby either. Elliot pressured her to go to New York, she said, where abortion was legal. Oh, when she got to this part, I felt so worried for her, my mom. I was only 7 or 8, but I had heard the nightmare stories. I knew the woman she was named after had died from complications of an abortion. "Oh, Mommy," I'd say, "that sounds so scary." Then she told me how she couldn't go through with it, didn't go through with it. And then I'd let out a breath. I was always too scared to breathe during these stories. I knew I must stay still, silent. Any interruption was an attack, and she would retreat. When she was done, I always asked questions, but she said nothing more, and eventually we fell asleep. Molly and the girl she chose to keep. Later, when she was awake, I asked, "If I was never born, who would be Blair?" And she roared with laughter. I let out a small giggle. I had pleased her with my wit. She laughed so hard, clearly and deeply, I burrowed underneath the blanket next to her, close, breathing her in. "Who would be Blair?" my mom says, when I visit her for the last time. I've been told that story all my life, in many ways been defined by it. Unwanted. I wonder if I absorbed my mother's ambivalence about having me, even in utero. I wonder if it's embedded deep within me, a part of my DNA. Perhaps feeling guilty that she often told me how she hadn't wanted me, my mother took pains to show me I had earned the right to be here, that I was special to her. "Dear Mom, don't show Lizzie. I want to spend a day alone with you. You said today was the day, but you are spending more time with Lizzie. Do you love her better? It's awful staying here while you are having fun with Lizzie. I wanted to make whatever Bronya is making, but Katie told me that she was. Katie is a brat. She didn't even use the tape recorder once. I like to hear tapes all the time, but I can't because you like to hear your books on tape, and you told me to give it to Katie. You don't care when I'm hurt. P.S. I'm crying. I wish you'd send Katie away. From me, unloved. You hate me. Show love, please. I'll die if you don't. Teardrops. Proof." And I circled it. When I was 5, my mother entrusted to me her beloved doll named Skinny, a childhood relic she had swiped from a store. Skinny was well-worn and well-loved. Her face covered in filmy gossamer fabric, small stitches for 2 blue eyes and a red mouth. I found the doll in Katie's closet one Sunday in October and begged her to let me keep her. My mother told me to be careful because Skinny was her prized possession, along with her other doll, Checkers, who was too fragile to touch. When she left for work the next day, I missed her, as always, but now I had Skinny. A part of Mom, my prize. Our nanny, Mrs. Ross, asked me what that filthy doll was. "It wasn't filthy," I said. "It was old." I told her it had been my mother's. She yanked it out of my hands and threw it in the garbage. When Mrs. Ross returned her attention to the small black and white portable television set that she watched during the day at our kitchen table, I took Skinny out of the trash. I carried Skinny around all week and showed her my world, carefully avoiding Mrs. Ross, until she opened the door to my bedroom and found me cradling the little rag doll. In 2 giant steps, she strode across the room, pulled Skinny from my hands. Mrs. Ross's own soft skin pulled apart Skinny's blue cloth flesh and ripped her limb from limb. I watched, stricken, When she was done, she tossed the pieces in the garbage. "I told you not to play with that doll," she said, and then she left the room. After dinner that night, I showed my mother the tragedy that had befallen Skinny under my care. I felt horrible, guilty, and unworthy. Most of all, I felt so sad for my mother. She picked the limbs out of the garbage, one by one, and examined them. She took Skinny's parts back to her room and sewed her up with pink thread as I watched silently from the doorway. Then she hid Skinny from me. She never said a word about it to Mrs. Ross. Another morning when I was in kindergarten, I was down in the basement when I heard a shriek. "Get out of my house!" It was my mother's voice, directed at Mrs. Ross. I raced up the stairs to see what was going on. When I reached the top, I cracked open the dark wooden door to the kitchen, just as a coffee cup flew through the air. A skid, followed by a smash. The mug landed on the tulip table, scarring its polished white top before falling to the floor. Fragments of blue and white china scattered like confetti. Brown coffee dripped from the wallpaper. Mrs. Ross looked stunned. "You are crazy," she said. I retreated down the steps back to the safety of the basement. I didn't know what to do. I pulled out one of the mildewed books from the shelf, A Very Young Dancer by Jill Kremenz. It was my favorite. In a series of black and white photographs, a girl demonstrated each ballet position, first, second, third, fourth, fifth. I took solace in the photos of the girl who looked so sure and unblemished. I felt a solidarity with her. She was forever trapped in the book, just as I felt trapped in this home in my family's basement. Unsure of what was unfolding above me, I made myself get lost in the pages. There she was, preparing to be Clara in the Nutcracker. There she was, eating dinner with her family. There she was, riding a sled through the snow with her handsome prince. I looked up and saw Mrs. Ross standing before me. In this downstairs realm, adults so rarely entered. She stood over me, wringing her fat hands. "Your mother no longer wants me to work for her. I won't be coming here again." She paused. "I hope you'll be okay." I didn't say anything to her, the only other constant in my life. A long moment passed. Finally, I looked back at my book. I heard Mrs. Ross gather her things and leave through the back door. I didn't even say goodbye. I stared at the wooden veneer walls, the plastic tea set on the shelf. I wondered who would take me to school. A few minutes later, my mother came down the steps. Now this was a first, my mother in my territory. I was mildly excited and nervous. She looked around as if seeing it all for the first time. Then she looked back at me. "Mrs. Ross is gone for good," she said conclusively. "I guess you will have to go to daycare in the morning because I will be at work." And that was all. My mother disappeared up the stairs and out of my view, back into the kitchen. I heard footsteps, the sound of sweeping, a chair scraping the floor. Footsteps retreating back into my mother's bedroom, double doors shut. Upstairs, I pieced some things together. When I tiptoed past my mother's room later, and the door was ajar again, I could see piles of folded laundry on the bed. And then I knew. Mrs. Ross had entered my mother's room, which was forbidden. Perhaps she thought my mother had already left for work. The underwear and socks were the witnesses of her transgression. In the kitchen, the coffee-stained wallpaper stayed that way for the remainder of my childhood. I never knew if nobody cared enough to wipe it clean, or if my mother wanted a visual reminder of what happened when her privacy was violated. The white table, with its small brown gash, like the end of a scream, was never replaced. After Mrs. Ross was fired, my mother found me the least terrible of the daycare centers in our area. I hated it, but I loved the journey to get there. My mother drove me herself in her new silver Monte Carlo with red velour interior, a red exterior pinstripe. The car had a sunroof and an 8-track player. I would spend 2 hours at the dismal daycare center, and then I'd shuttle over to Stevenson Elementary. I hated daycare, mostly because one of my classmates swiped the treat out of my lunch every day. With Mrs. Ross gone, I could tell a real confidant that someone was stealing the best part of my day. My mother knew exactly what to do. She started stapling the bag shut. There, now the thief will have to find someone else to prey on. And that was the end of that. From the time we were very little, Lizzie and I wanted to ride horses. Anytime I'd see a field, which typically meant the big stretches of grass off the road on our 2-mile walk to the mall, I could picture galloping over the land on a horse. I'd tell Lizzie, and she agreed. Oh, we'd declare, if only we could cross this country on horseback. One evening, after we'd begged my mom for years, she came home from work and said, "Guess what? You girls are getting riding lessons." And I thought, my life is going to change. This was a big deal because my mom worked, and because Hillel, my parochial day school, didn't do sports, I never played anything until high school, though I was athletic when it came to solo pursuits like gymnastics or figure skating. I was not an athlete. Even in the best of times, I couldn't run a mile because I could never catch my breath. That weekend, my mother took Lizzie and me to Haverhill Farms, a riding school, and the only place near us where you could get lessons without having your own horse. Lizzie, wearing a plaid shirt, got right on her horse and trotted off, her head going up and down, a dust cloud billowing behind her. I got a horse named Humphrey, whose only interest was eating grass. I couldn't get him to do anything. I had no idea how to make a horse go. I spent the entire lesson sitting on top of a grazing horse, pulling on reins with too much slack. Piling into the Corvette afterward, my mother said, impressed, "Oh, Lizzie, you really went." I knew how I did. I didn't need to ask. When we got home, I asked if I could take lessons still. My mom turned to me and said, "You're not ready." And that was that. My mother believed in spending money on people who were ready. Otherwise, it was a waste. It was a real heartbreak. A year later, she let me try again a few times. It was winter, and a half dozen students were in the indoor barn. They put me on a white horse named Cloud. We were trotting in a circle when I started sliding sideways toward the inside of the ring. The saddle slipped down, and so I fell. I was given a leg up again, but I was shaken. Well, that was that again, Selma. I never pushed my mom to let me keep riding. I knew that I wasn't good enough. So Lizzie got to put on the velvet hat and learn to ride, to live my dream. Every week when Lizzie was at her lesson, my mother and I would go to the bakery to pick up a nice challah to have ready when she got home. Sometimes I would hold Lizzie's helmet and wish it were mine. In our room, she would saddle up with our towels and let me ride her instead. I'd climb onto her back, watching my posture in the mirror, her hands on the bed. Lizzie, as a horse, taught me everything she learned at her lessons, which was useful, actually, when I finally learned to ride in young adulthood. She was, and still is, the best big sister. But my mom was still my favorite person, and it made me sad to miss her when she was away at work all day. But as we grew, weekends became reserved for me and Lizzie. Every Saturday, we crammed into my mom's navy blue Stingray with the white leather bucket seats. The car had a tape deck, which was a new thing then. If Katie was with us, she sat in the front seat, Lizzie and I in the back. My mom smoked Vantage cigarette after Vantage cigarette, and as she would say, we tooled around all day. We mostly accompanied her on shopping trips, admiring as she tried on clothes at the nicest boutiques we had, beautiful shops with sofas and mirrors, and candy and pretty dishes. My mother loved to be treated well, and I loved to watch her be treated well. She wrote a check for whatever she bought, lighting a cigarette as she filled it out. Every time, she would say, "It calms me. Thank you." Most of those pieces remained part of her wardrobe until the day she died. On all our shopping trips, I never drank water because those Saturdays were so special, I wouldn't do anything to derail them. I learned early that with three girls, if we needed a bathroom and couldn't find one, my mother would throw up her hands and say, "Just forget it, we're all going home." So I went without water, and if I did need the restroom, I learned not to say anything about it, whimpering to Lizzie, who begged me to stay quiet. I had constant bladder infections, but I didn't often report about those either, because it would irritate my mother. If I had to go pee in a cup, it would mean she needed to take the day off work to bring me to the doctor. Then she would get more irritated if I got a stage fright bladder and say, "We're going to be stuck in rush hour." I tried to keep my ailments to myself. In addition to bladder problems, I often had a fever. FUO, they called it. Fever of unknown origin. For years, I kept a graph of my temperature per the doctor's instructions. I had a fever almost every single day in fourth, fifth, and sixth grades. Often, my body felt out of control, as if the connection between my brain and my limbs had been severed. One morning when I was in kindergarten, I discovered a pain in my left leg. "My leg hurts," I said as my mother was racing off to work. She didn't pay it much mind. "It really, really hurts." I dragged my leg across her bedroom to demonstrate the pain and how it gave out. Perhaps this was unnecessary, but it felt to me as if I should be dragging it. My mother just laughed. She kept on laughing as she told the story for years. "What a drama queen. What an actress dragging that leg across the floor." I learned that I couldn't show pain, and I certainly couldn't talk about it. To do so would only provoke laughter. Now, as an adult, I happen to experience pain in the same leg, a drop foot. Looking back, it's hard to know what was real and what was drama. As a kid, you have new pains, but you don't have a vocabulary for them. Maybe it was a sign, or maybe it was nothing at all. As I grew up, it became apparent that I wasn't just dramatic. I was also unusually coordinated, limber, stretchy. Since early playground years, I knew how to use my body in a physical way. I was quick and nimble, and I entertained with my physicality. My mother didn't believe in enrolling us in organized athletics. She was no soccer mom cheering on the sidelines. But certain individual sports came so easily: skiing, diving, ice skating, tennis. I could become proficient in a matter of days without any formal gymnastics training. I could stand and do a backflip. A back handspring punctuated a sentence. I used my body dramatically, to dramatic ends. Because I was so acrobatic, my mother hired a wonderful girl, Beth Willis, from my sister Katie's class at Kingswood, to come teach Lizzie and me gymnastics. She was a competitive gymnast, the exact thing I pretended to be at the park, which felt quite official. Their curriculum was a very homemade hodgepodge, a teenage girl demonstrating moves in a low-ceilinged suburban basement. But I took it seriously. My mom bought us some mats, and Beth taught us how to do back handsprings. She brought over her old balance beam, and I learned how to do a back walkover on it as my mom had her evening martini admiring my basic talent. I was adept at doing flips, but I had to keep them low. My aerial cartwheel stayed close to the ground, because if I went any higher, I would hit the ceiling. That's the funny thing about limitations. Sometimes they aren't about you at all. The ceiling was always there, and I didn't know any better. So I kept low to the ground, causing my audience to wince, afraid my neck would break. When I got to college, I went through a period where I tried to be a real gymnast. It blew me away. There was a whole wide world out there. Space, height, breathing room. When I did an aerial cartwheel for the first time, I flew. I didn't know without the limitations of a ceiling, I could do a double. I still find myself looking for the safety of the ground. I still think small, accommodate for the low ceiling. I'm just now learning that the ceiling is imaginary. It's a relief and also disorienting. Nothing is what I thought. I felt very connected to that dark, smoky home because it was my life. It was my mother. It was what I knew in that house. As a kid, I held tight to the belief that I never wanted to leave. When I grow up, I'd think, I'll come back and live here. I hadn't realized that in some ways that's exactly what I did. I brought that house and its limitations with me everywhere I went. My son is a natural gymnast, much like me. And as I watched him practicing his flips, I saw he had a tendency to go low, like his mother before him. He looks for the safety of the ground. You gotta go up, kid, I told him, pointing to the sky. And he did a clear high flip. I bought him a trampoline because I want him to go higher. I pray that he always will. There is so much that adults do unknowingly to children. To a child's mind, any mind really, the smallest moments can become the biggest stories, images that change our lives forever. It was a weeknight, September 1981, and Mom took Lizzie and me in the Corvette to see An American Werewolf in London. It was a big deal to be out with our mom on a school night after dark. She bought jujubes and parceled them out, immediately taking out a filling. I was 8 or 9 at the time, and I had no business seeing this movie. It's a comedy, gore, horror, and for all I know, the movie is hilarious. I haven't seen it since. What I do know is that I didn't recognize the comedy at that age. I saw only the terror. The movie opens on a scene where the young leads, Jack and David, whose dark hair reminded me of mine and Lizzie's, leave this bar in the Yorkshire countryside. They're jubilant and singing, maybe drunk, when they're viciously attacked by a werewolf. Jack is mauled to death. David goes on, seeing his decomposing friend throughout the film. That moment was the end of my childhood. I hadn't grasped, until that moment, the reality of what death does. Until then, it had been an afterthought, a vague, distant mystery that happened to people you didn't know. But that night I understood. Death is real, and it can happen unexpectedly. I would be dead someday. My mother would be dead someday. It took my breath away. I hadn't considered it really since I learned about death at age 3. This is what I carried home in my mother's navy blue Stingray. At home, I put my head on the pillow and tried to push out the images of dead bodies. It was too much for me. I felt unsafe everywhere, convinced that Lizzie and I would be ambushed, like the men in the movie. For weeks, I told my friends at school everything I could remember about the story. For nearly 2 years, I couldn't be alone in a room at night. When the lights went out, the dark pictures haunted me. A charred corpse beckoned from Lizzie's bed. I cowered in the shadows, sobbing softly into my pillow, wishing someone would come in and hold me. No matter how much I cried, my mother wouldn't come. She needed to get up early for work. She did not allow me to sleep in the big bed with her. Whenever I tried, my dad carried me back to my room, where I stayed awake most of the night. It went on this way, every day, for a year and a half. I kept my Aunt Anna's fox stole in my arms as a protection. I was sensitive and deeply affected by things, which I think made my childhood quite different from my sister's. I still need to edit what I watch. My experiences were all or nothing, an exercise in extremes. This was a story I carried throughout my life, and still do, to some degree. Lizzie is a mom to two children who are everything to her, and we rarely discuss our own childhoods. But the other day, I asked her if she remembered the movie, this night that irrevocably terrorized me, a movie she seemed to have been unfazed by. That movie really fucked me up, Blair. It changed my life. Gobsmacked! I had no idea she ever felt that way. I can still see her sitting in that passenger bucket seat, saying how much she liked it. I remember getting out of Mom's Corvette that night thinking, I don't know how I'm ever going to be okay. It was a revelation to me. Lizzie was the tough one, acting nonchalant about big, scary things. My big sister, always so brave. She pretended she enjoyed it. I didn't know the truth. We play the parts we are given. We become the stories that are told about us. Lizzie was tough, her assigned role. She was the one who carried me on her back, and she wasn't going to let me down. Still, she wasn't able to help me, and my misery saddened her beyond my understanding. When I cried every night and she didn't console me, I never imagined she was silently experiencing her own brand of terror. Lizzie grew up to embody everything strong and tough. She was stronger than most boys in her class. She ran hurdles and rode on the back of a motorcycle, embraced an athletic lifestyle. She became a cop after college, a hostage negotiator, to discover that deep down, she had been just as afraid, but she never said a word. That rocked me almost as much as that scene had so many years before. I am so sorry, she cried into the phone. Blair, I am so sorry. And I was sorry too. As adults, we pull our childhoods with us wherever we go. Elliot. When I look back on the characters of the past, my memories of my father are indistinct. I don't think I ever saw him clearly. I wish I could go back with wiser eyes. I always liked his name, Elliot, but I never responded to the man with it. From early on, it was apparent that I was proudly my mother's daughter, and she required all my love and devotion. I could tell my mother was impartial toward her husband, with whom she maintained a cordial, if not cold, relationship throughout their marriage. So I didn't try very hard to please him. It was my mother who commanded my attention. She was the person I wanted to kiss me goodnight every night. She had the footsteps I ran out of my room toward. She had tremendous power over me. But some nights when she was working late, my only option was Elliot. When he came to the bedroom I shared with Lizzie, he would jokingly ask her, "Who is your favorite, Mom or Dad?" And she would answer, "Tosca." who was the German Shepherd down the street. She knew how to handle his questions. She knew how to play him, and he would be amused. He never dared ask me that. He already knew the answer. Well, our home life was humble compared with that of my wealthier friends. Vacations were utopian. Where our house was marked by grim darkness and a shag pea-green family room carpet. For me, vacations meant sunshine and pools, fresh pineapple, platters of breakfast room service, and chance encounters with other kids. As children, we had such beautiful vacations that it became my life's pleasure to try to recreate them. To this day, a good hotel is still what I think of as the highest luxury. In the 1970s and 1980s, my family would go on these gambling junkets, Elliot's thing, over Christmas and spring break. We kids would all get one suite, my parents another. There was coconut ice cream and Shasta, with more fresh pineapple and a pink umbrella, which we could charge to the room. Most thrilling was the sense of adventure and independence. In my own house, I felt I was waiting for my turn to begin. In my school day, I never ate the lunches packed for me, typically salami or peanut butter sandwiches. I had a nervous stomach, Maalox in my backpack. I was embarrassed to eat in front of people. It was too vulnerable, too sensual. But on vacation, I ate everything. I returned to my normal life feeling sated. One year when I was in third grade, we took a trip to Aruba that was comped by the hotel, another junket. I don't know the details beyond that my father hadn't gambled at the prescribed hour or that he hadn't lost enough. Though they certainly had enough money to cover the rooms, my dad decided to leave in the middle of the night to avoid the unexpected expenditure of the vacation, on principle. I never really understood why my mom went along with this, only that Elliot was quite careful with the dollar. One of a collection of things my mother hated about him. Early in the morning, under the cover of darkness, we secretly left the hotel without checking out and sped to the airport. Katie was so afraid. She kept saying that we were like the Von Trapp children fleeing in the night. I somehow wasn't scared, merely inconvenienced. And was fine just as long as I didn't get separated from my mother. Even at 8 years old, I couldn't make sense of why he didn't just settle up. I remember asking, is this really worth it? Sure enough, someone from the hotel met us at the airport, and Elliot was forced to settle his bill. In the end, we weren't criminals. We were just people who ended our vacation early. We still took trips as a family, but that was the last junket we went on. Hillel. The role of Judaism in my family was a tricky thing. My sisters and I were all raised in the Jewish tradition, even though my mother never called herself Jewish. Judaism is matrilineal. Still, I always found it curious, given that her beloved father was Jewish, and her mother, for whom she had only disdain, was Scottish and not a Jew, that she chose to identify as Anglican. In her jewelry box, she kept a cross that read, "In case of emergency, contact an Episcopal priest." She never wore it, out of deference to Elliot and our family, but I always knew it was there. Even though my mother herself didn't identify as Jewish, it was important to her that I did. I was her chosen one. This became my first big role. To perform Jewishness. Over the years, it became a strange interweaving, where she would pit me against myself, telling me that I needed to be Jewish, telling me that I could never truly be. My mother never socialized with any Jewish people. As a kid, I used to think she believed they were beneath her. As my sister Katie would say, she would have hidden a Jew, but she doesn't want to be friends with one. But now, in hindsight, I suspect she felt as if she didn't truly belong. Growing up, we never had a Christmas tree. We celebrated Hanukkah and fasted on Yom Kippur. Even my mother fasted, She was always respectful of our Jewish rituals. Her disdain ran somewhere beneath the surface, never outwardly visible. The Holocaust was at the front of her mind at all times. She referred to it often, citing the atrocity of Sophie's Choice and anchoring me firmly in the mindset of do not forget. My parents sent their three younger daughters to Hillel Day School, partly out of respect for Elliot, but mostly out of convenience. We could take the bus to Hillel, which meant my mother wouldn't have to drive us to school every morning. Never mind that the bus ride took an hour and a half because we were the first to get on. It was a fully immersive Jewish education. Talmud study, prayer every morning, minyan, a congregation of students engaging in daily Hebrew instruction. I remember feeling grateful to have had this education. Still, my mother made it clear that in her view, Hillel was not the be-all and end-all. Once we were part of the Hillel community, we pretended to be good Jews. We played the part well. We overcompensated. We opposite of Anne Franked. Our family went above and beyond in our Jewish calling. We stopped eating ham at home in case one of our more observant friends came over and wanted to stay for dinner. My mother kept two sets of dishes, which she liked to brag about. "I keep two sets of dishes," she would say to shopkeepers who nodded politely, "one for milk and one for meat." The truth was, we didn't really keep the plates separate, so none of them were kosher. Thank God we never hosted an Orthodox person in our home, so these lies didn't actually harm anyone. In my journals, I wrestled with whether I believed in God. I wanted to believe. I love the idea of God. "Dear book," I wrote, ending each searching entry with "the end," in case I died before the next one, then crossing it out every time I sat down to write. At school, the fear of God was put into me, as well as the idea that we, the Jews, were his chosen people. I knew, given the usual metric of Judaism, passing down through the matrilineal line, I wasn't really a Jew. But at school, no one could know this. We needed to keep it a secret. I officially became a Jew when I was in second grade. My mother asked if I wanted to convert because Katie had wanted to, and bat mitzvah time was approaching. "Selma, do you want to be Jewish too?" She sat at the table after a dinner our new housekeeper made, smoking and drinking a glass of wine, dabbing her red lips. I said that I did. My conversion took place during the time I wore an eye patch. In first grade at Hillel, we were all given an eye test, and mine came back saying I needed glasses. So we went to the eye doctor, Leonard Lerner, coincidentally the father of the kids who screamed about the mean Beitner baby. It was here I discovered I had a severe lazy eye. "We must take care of this right away," he said. I was told I'd need to wear an eye patch for exactly 2 years. "We must trick the brain," he said, a speech I came to imitate. Whenever anyone asked why I wore an eye patch, I would repeat, "We must trick the brain." Emphasis on trick. We bought patches from the drugstore, black fabric with a little point in the center like the dart of a dress. They were a bit Gautier, like Madonna's cone bra. The patch was sweaty in the summer, with a smell like a wet Band-Aid. It pushed my face down into an even meaner scowl. A mean baby pirate. I knew I wasn't pretty with my eye patch on, but my mother was supportive. She would draw on my patches to make them cuter. I followed the doctor's words like the gospel. I never removed the eye patch. The conversion process is immersion in a mikvah, a bath from which you emerge from holy water reborn as a Jew. Mine was lined with salmon-colored tiles, like something you'd find in a hospital bathroom. Before entering the mikvah, you are instructed to remove everything from your person, clothes, earrings, even traces of nail polish. But I refused to take off my eye patch. Dr. Lerner had been clear. I must never, ever remove it. "You know, you're not really Jewish if you keep that on," said the woman at the synagogue who is presiding over us girls, gesturing to my eye patch. But the rabbi, coincidentally, the senior rabbi at Hillel, let it slide and gave me my conversion papers. For many years afterward, Katie would tease, "You didn't remove the eye patch, so you aren't really a Jew." To which I would say, "Shut up." The day we removed the patch, my vision was perfect. 2020. Vayahi or, I yelled, "Let there be light!" Everyone laughed. 3 days later, my vision went back to the way it had been. The brain was not tricked. It will always choose the easiest way. And the easiest way, in this case, was to turn that eye off. To this day, if I put one hand over my good eye, I cannot see. I still have a patch. I put it on every once in a while, thinking maybe I'll trick the brain. But the brain and I both know better. The first time I got drunk, it was a revelation. I always liked Passover. Every year, as my family and I celebrated the exodus of the Jews, I actually felt that hope of next year in Jerusalem as we sang in the Haggadah. I dunked my parsley in the salt water and tasted the pain of our tears. I loaded my matzah with horseradish, and as I took small sips of the small glasses of manischewitz I was allowed throughout the Seder, I felt warm, at one with my ancestors. A light flooded through me, filling me up with the warmth of God. As a little kid, I loved God. Huge fan. But the year I was 7, when we basically had manischewitz on tap and no one at the table was paying attention to my consumption level, I put it together. In that moment in the dining room, with the plagues and the frogs and the hail and the locusts, there came an epiphany. I realized, as I kept refilling my glass, the feeling was not God, but fermentation. That was heartbreaking to me, because it felt like finding out Santa Claus wasn't real, if I'd cared about Santa Claus. It was also very convenient that I made this discovery at the table, where there was a glass of wine already in front of me. I thought, well, this is a huge disappointment. But since it turns out I can get the warmth of the Lord from a bottle, thank God there's one right here. Because I wasn't very much of a planner, nor an in-the-moment critical thinker, I got drunk that night. Very drunk. The kind of drunk that would make most people never drink again. I rolled around the living room floor, then clung to my cousin Matt's leg, weeping and begging him not to leave me. I was out of control. Eventually, I was put in Katie's bigger bed with her, where I slept next to her all night long. A clear sign that I was gone, if ever there was one. In the morning, I woke up and didn't remember how I'd gotten there. So now I knew. The relief I sought could be found in an inexpensive, sticky sweet bottle, or any bottle. It wasn't spiritual. It was scientific. I didn't go back to it right away, but I knew it was there. A few months later, there was this fly in the house that wouldn't leave me alone. It buzzed around and around the living room before landing on the cream carpet right next to the bookshelf. I squatted near the fly, attempting to swat it. But there was no need. It was already dead. That's when I saw it, an old paperback wedged between S.E. Hinton's Outsiders and Judy Blume's Forever. I pulled it out and looked at the cover, intrigued. Sarah T., Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic. The book's pages were well-worn and stained, indicating it must have made the rounds with my sisters. The book was about a sad, misfit girl who turns to alcohol as a coping mechanism. I opened it up and started reading. With that bleak, dead fly as my witness, I read the book from cover to cover. What an adventure! As my eyes scanned the pages, I thought, this is how I'm going to be okay. I was gloomy and sensitive.